We're here to talk about parenting, and specifically the Ten Commandments of Parenting, which is a catchy title. But I do really think that I've assembled a list of good do's and don'ts, so to speak, as parents. And I think one of the most important things to keep in mind is that, that nobody's perfect. And for sure, parenting is very difficult, and at different times, it's difficult. And that you don't have to be perfect. You just have to be around enough. And when I say around, I don't just be around physically, although being around physically is very important. I mean being around emotionally, being available, listening. You don't have to be perfect by far. Nobody is, and I'm sure all of us could talk about our own experiences as children, being parented, and the ways in which we had good times and bad times, and that's perfectly all right. The point is that we have to be good enough. In fact, there was a famous psychologist, Kohut, who talked about good enough parenting. That there's a certain amount of presence, certain amount of availability, reached a threshold that a child could develop a normal attachment and a normal. A certain amount of parenting, a certain amount of availability would allow the child to develop a normal sense of self. So we just have to be good enough. There was a true story, as far as I know, about a rabbi who was having a difficult time looking for a position. So he did, one of those position wanted ads, looking for a position. He wrote, "Mediocre rabbi looking for a position." So he got a call. "I'm sorry, you're overqualified." But really, we don't have to be superstars. We really don't. We just have to do a good enough job. So we'll talk about a good enough job. And of course, if you want to do better, kol hakavod. None of these ideas or rules stop you from being super. All I'm saying is that our children are not sitting there grading us. What they're looking for is experiences that allow them to feel okay in the world and learn things about the world and learn from you how to be. And sometimes those experiences are big or small. And there's many different ways to do it. So anyway, so starting with commandment number one, so to speak, which is do not forget to listen. That is a very important point. We're not talking about listening in a in a classical sense, like listening, hearing something, because probably we all listen. We don't shut our ears. We don't go, "I'm not listening to you." We might want to do that sometimes, but we don't usually do that. We're talking about listening as in some kind of serious consideration to what the child is saying. And listening, a lot of people confuse listening with agreeing or listening with obeying. And that's not true at all. You could listen to somebody and listen fully and think that they're wrong. And there's nothing about listening that has to convey that you think the person is right. What listening does is it conveys an impression that you're interested in what that person's experiences, the person's thoughts, wishes, which is all very important. After all, why would anybody, it doesn't make a difference how old the child is, why would anybody want to listen to somebody who doesn't listen to them? It's very simple, right? Basic respect. So we're talking about listening in a sense that no matter what's going on, that you have an open mind to really hear and see the other person's perspective. So, you may have an issue that you're really angry about with your child or feel your child needs to be disciplined. All that is a part and parcel of parenting. Sometimes you really have to get into some difficult conversations or do things that are uncomfortable for the child. Children will not grow if they're not uncomfortable at times. So the discomfort produces growth. So, you may have to do things. But when you do something, it's still nothing that stops you from first listening. A child gets a bad grade on a test, or a child gets has some trouble at school, and it seems very clear-cut to you, and you're really angry or frustrated. There's really nothing wrong with listening. And in fact, in the first parasha in the Torah, there's a really wonderful example of that, where after Adam and Chava eat from the Eitz HaDaas, and clearly they're in big trouble, and they know they're in big trouble, right? And they hear Kol Elokim Misalech Besoch Hagan, right? They hear that Hashem is coming, whatever that means, to walk through the garden, and they hide because they are embarrassed, ashamed of themselves. And when Hashem engages Adam in a conversation, the first thing he says is, Ayaka, where are you? Now, of course, he knows where he is. And then he says, Amina Eitz, Asher Tzivisicha, from the tree that I commanded you not to eat, did you eat? He asks the question. And, Adam makes an excuse, right, that we were naked and we covered ourselves. And then, Hashem says, well, then that, means that you ate. But the point is that even though, obviously, Hashem knew exactly what was going on, he engages Adam in this conversation. To why do we do that? Even if he's right, why does he do that? Because he does it because that's how you have to treat people. You have to engage them. You have to give them a chance to tell over their story. Even if in this case it was a baloney excuse, he still needed his chance to tell over his story. And then whatever followed, he'd be more receptive to whatever follows. So you really have to listen. And a lot of times if you listen, he might find that you're wrong. That might actually happen. It's okay. We'll talk about that later, but it's okay to be wrong. We have a whole set of views and perceptions, and they may be true in a lot of ways, but there's no harm in changing it. And if you listen with an open mind and you hear your child's perspective, it may very well be that you're wrong, or it may be that something has to be mitigated. But the point is, even if you're 100% right, as in the case that we discussed here in Bracious, even if you're 100% right and the other person's 100% wrong, the process of engagement, of asking somebody what's going on, what's this about, is really important. And asking with a genuine, open-minded curiosity, to really try to divest yourself of emotion and not be in an angry place at that point of time, and to actually have a genuine interest, a genuine curiosity. Why did you do this? What was going on? Why was it necessary? Or whatever it is that you ask. And then listen, and don't interrupt. Pirkei Avos tells us one of the signs of a golem, of an incomplete person, is somebody that interrupts other people when they're speaking. And people include children. There's no exception. All the halachas b'nadam l'chaveru apply to children too. Lashon hara, everything, the works, onas devarim, all those things. There's only one heter, which in fact plays itself out more with children than with adults, because oftentimes you're more in a position of providing guidance. So l'toelis, whether it's Lashon Hara, or I've heard many times from Rav David Cohen, it's not just Lashon Hara, all dinim beinam l'chavero, when it's l'toelis, are suspended. Meaning if you're doing it totally for the pure reason of helping the other person, so sometimes you could say Lashon Hara, or you could criticize, but it has to be with a complete goodness in your heart, not anger or rage, but really trying to help the other person. So the point is, oftentimes with children, because we have to discipline or guide them, we're in a position of toelis. But the reality is that all the laws of Benam Lechaver apply to children as they apply to adults, and they have to be treated with respect other than that. So we need to listen and hear them and not interrupt. And then when we listen to somebody, aside from the fact that we might change our own mind, which is a possibility, but truly the other person does feel a lot calmer and a lot more interested in listening to you, which is the goal. Because if we're going to guide our children, we need them to listen to us. If they're going to listen to us, we need to listen to them. So it takes it's something that's a sentence, but it really takes a lot of personal work to really come into a situation, even when you're very angry and very frustrated, and separate yourself for a minute, just detach yourself, and actually ask what's going on. And that is tremendous value, an important thing to do. So that's commandment number one. Don't forget to listen. Don't forget to listen. That's very important. A lot of times when you listen, the problem solves itself, because if you're dealing with a reflective child, an insightful child, then you, instead of attacking him, you keep listening. He or she might, on their own, fess up or concede. And it's always better, in my opinion, to go in the direction that the person is going than to take the direction they're not going. So, let's say you are getting into a hassle about schoolwork or a hassle about chores in the house and asking, so what's going on over here? And then the child says, well, I suppose I should, you know, work on making my room more neat. Instead of getting down the whole laundry list of four or five other things you want to criticize on that topic, if the child's conceding that they need to make the room more neat, go with that, because he or she is there. Say, well, really, how would you like to do that? I'm listening. You know, so listening is just one of the most important things to do. And it's very hard to do. It just is very hard to do because we're in our own heads. We spend most of the day in our own heads. And sometimes that's a good neighborhood. Sometimes that's a bad neighborhood. But we spend most of the day in our own heads. It's very hard to get out of our heads and listen to somebody else. But it's very, very valuable. Okay, so mistake number two. Another very important thing is being afraid to admit that you're wrong. And that's a very tricky thing. That's not as straightforward as listening, because you don't want to really always be wrong. I mean, how are your children supposed to look up to you and take guidance from you, admire you, respect you, if you're wrong? That is a real problem. On the other hand, you know, especially today, I mean, children are very—they're exposed to a lot of ideas. They have access to a tremendous amount of information, be that as it may. And you can't pull the wool over their eyes. I mean, if you're wrong about something, and it's apparent that you're wrong, you run the risk of losing respect by not fessing up that you're wrong. So, you know, we have a problem. And then, you know, again, going back to Avos, there's a lot of good ideas in Avos about relationships and people. Right, Ezu Mechubad and Mechabad is Habrios. You know, who is respected? One who respects others. So, if you're wrong about something, particularly, and we'll talk about a distinction in a minute, but particularly if you're wrong that you did something wrong to the child, that you were really wrong in what you did, then you know, if you don't respect that and come clean, then how are you going to earn that respect? And to a degree, you know, respect has to be earned, even though it's the child's obligation. It's always a child's obligation to respect the parents no matter what. But there's a dialectic between the child's obligation and the parent's obligation, because the parent's obligation to create a situation where it's easy and conducive for the child to respect you. We see in Chazal, for example, that a person is not supposed to, you know, in their days it was more commonplace than it is now, but whatever the case may be, we do this today too, but the Gemara says a person should not hit his elder child. And it doesn't mean bar mitzvah, it means even younger. It means old enough that the child would be aroused to aggression and be tempted to hit the parent back. Because it's lifnei iver. So it's your over lifnei iver if you treat the child in that way. Now, in the time of the Gemara, it was pretty commonplace. That was a common form of discipline. Today, people have different views about that. Some do, some don't. It's a different discussion. But the point is that you can extrapolate. In different times, there are different things. That means if you yelled at a child, at a teenager, in a way that would arouse the child to answer back and give you mouth, then you're also over lifnei iver, because it's the same thing. You know, you have to be able to connect the dots and understand that maybe it's not, since Chazal didn't say that was usher, so it's not the same iser, but common sense. The point was, do not make it hard for your kids to respect you. Give them reason to respect you. Don't tempt them. So, obviously, admitting that we're wrong is a part of it. Now, there's really two kinds of wrong, right? There's a mistake that affects your relationship with the child. Let's say you lost your temper and you really went postal and you called the child names, you know, idiot, or in other ways you offended the child, or maybe you rebuked the child at the Shabbos table in front of other children, which again, as I said, is completely unnecessary. And not only that, that all the dinim of Benon Chavero apply, that there's no reason to humiliate a child unless you have some strange notion that by humiliating him or her in front of the family, that will, quote, teach him or her a lesson. I don't see how that would work. But it happens in family process. You know, nobody's perfect. You lose your temper and you yell. That requires an apology. You know, you embarrassed your child. I mean, alpi din requires an apology. You have to ask for a fila. So that's one kind of problem. That's a mistake where it affects the relationship. And then there's mistakes. Your child sees that you make a mistake. Maybe a child sees you display a little bad case of road rage, or or catches you being lax with a certain mitzvah or iser. These are things that you have to deal with. So those are other kinds of mistakes. Now they don't affect the child, right? But they do. So in the second case, it's a little different. In the second case, you definitely have to promptly admit. If you're wrong about something, you have to promptly admit it. There's no point your child caught you dead to rights, or you suspect. Sometimes it might not be, the child may be very respectful and not say anything, but you know that you were caught, whatever the case may be. You did something wrong, or you felt you were a bad role model to the child, and you need to point it out. Yesterday I got upset in line and I screamed at that person in the grocery store. I want you to know that was a weakness on my part. It was incorrect behavior. You have to admit it, but don't make a big deal about it. Don't make a capital case, because it doesn't really affect your child's relationship. So you don't have to be going and asking for mechila or anything, but you need to be very clear about it, because it's important to be honest. You want to teach a child honesty, self-honesty, courage to admit your defects. All these things are very important. So you do it clearly. You explain what you did wrong. You could explain, if you have a plan, how you're fixing it. And you move on. You don't turn your child into your confidant or your confessee that you tell him or her all of your problems in life and all of your weaknesses. But on the other hand, it happens. Be clear about it. Move on. It's more difficult. It's more difficult if you did something really to hurt the child. That's a real problem, because here, on the one hand, you need to maintain authority. And on the other hand, a little bit, they've got one over on you, because you can ask for forgiveness, but what if the child doesn't want to forgive you? What if they still hold a grudge against you, perhaps legitimately? What if it's something you've done many times? And we do that in families. Nobody's perfect by far. So that's much more difficult. So there you got to walk a fine line. On the one hand, you really have to take responsibility for what you did wrong. And you have to be clear. This was wrong. I shouldn't have done it. I need to change. I ask that you forgive me. Again, keep it simple and quick. Get in there, get out. It's surgical strike. Hopefully the child will say, yeah, I forgive you. If the child doesn't forgive you, you have to be very careful. You can't end up being in a position where the child's holding you hostage to the mechila. Even though al-pidin, you really need the mechila. It's a big problem. So what you got to do is get the sense. Ask, is there something that I didn't understand here? Is there some other, is there a reason why you don't want to forgive me? Take it, don't get defensive. Take it and hear it. If in a few minutes, the thing could be resolved, then resolve it. Then own up if the child makes a point. And it's irrelevant. The other thing you have to realize, and you want to teach a child this lesson too, he might have done six things wrong, and you yelled at him and embarrassed him in public, right, in the family or whatever. He did six things wrong. He hasn't made amends what he's done. But that's, you can't run the show on that. You have to take responsibility for your own actions. If you did something wrong, you've got to show you did it wrong and apologize. And even though the child did what they did, separate it. Wait a few hours, like between milchiks and fleishiks. Get your apology in, correct it, let it settle in, show that you have integrity, show that you have courage, show that you're a decent person. And a while later, go back to the child and say, I appreciate this and I take responsibility for what I did. I'd like to talk to you about what you did. And pursue it. There's no reason, you don't have to walk with your tail between your legs, but it's very bad form to, in the middle of your seeking apology, to go ahead and attack the other person. No one likes that. No one likes those buts. I was wrong, but you were wronger. No one likes that. That's not nice. And like I said, you have to treat your children with the same respect that you treat anybody. So a lot of times in these situations, right, there's many guilty parties, because your child might have, quote, really had it coming, end quote. Child had it coming in some way. It doesn't mean that you had to do what you did, but so that's okay. It's okay to apologize. It's okay to apologize first, and later on to remember to pursue it. If for whatever reason, in a few minutes, you can't sort it out, leave it. Come back another day. You really need to get mechila at a certain point, but you cannot risk sitting around there and getting caught in this endless, you know, back and forth. You give your child the chance to explain really what the problem is, and if you miss something, because usually if somebody doesn't want to forgive you, usually it's because they feel in some way you haven't really corrected the problem, and it might be legitimate, you know. So you can ask, help me understand why it's difficult for you to forgive at this point. Is there something I'm missing? But after that, and after you try it, if it doesn't work, you can't grovel. You move on, you leave it for now. You say, I do take responsibility. You don't have to forgive me if you don't want to forgive me. It belongs to you, your forgiveness. But I want you to know I take responsibility. I'm making efforts not to make that kind of, you know, mistake again. And we'll talk about it another time. And that's what you do. So it's important to be able to admit that you're wrong. I don't think that you'll weaken your authority by being wrong. You could change. The other things that are very important too is you can change your plan in the middle. You know, even if you're doing, I don't believe that you have to, you know, be 100% consistent with discipline. You have to be consistent enough. But the reality is there may be a reason why whatever you chose to do isn't really working, isn't working for the child, isn't working for you. You could talk about it, you could discuss it, you can suggest an alternative. These are all normal things of being a parent. It happens all the time. You have a problem. If you're making mistakes all the time, admitting you're wrong all the time to your child, you have a problem too. You need to figure out how to get better at what you're doing. But de facto, once you make the mistake, if you've done something wrong and you need to apologize for it, then you do need to apologize. Okay, so commandment number 3, and that is, do not feel overly responsible for your child's happiness and success. That's a very important point. It's something that systemically is hard, because it's not just us. We have our own feelings as parents, of course. We want nachas, we want to succeed, but we're part of a very close-knit kind of community. If you're part of the religious community, it's not so easy to separate your life from your child's life. The more traditional community is, the more ethnic a community is, the more the boundaries, you know, are blurred. And so it's not completely realistic, right? To a degree, you are judged by how your children behave. And your children are judged to a degree by how you behave. You know, perhaps it's overrated and there's a lot of panic about it, but, you know, people worry about shidduchim. They want to give the best impression. Many of the people here are not yet of the age that they have children that are shidduchim. Some of you are, but whatever it is, you'll see, you know, when it plays out. You know, as strong-minded as you want to be and feel that you can chart your own course, you don't have to worry about what other people think. You know, the social pressures are very intense. Very, very intense. So it's on the one hand, you know, on the one hand, it makes perfect sense that we don't need to take responsibility, over responsibility for our child's happiness and success. He or she have to chart their own course in life and figure out what they want to do. But on the other hand, we do belong to a community where there's an expectation, and everybody looks at like a family almost as one unit. So we do feel a lot of pressure. And, you know, even in school, being in a classroom here, it reminds me of, you know, all those experiences. You know, the schools oftentimes too, you may feel, you know, your child needs to learn how to deal with consequences or homework or studying, and you may have an idea in your head. But who gets dragged into the principal's office? You, not the children. You know, it's almost, and sometimes it's very difficult. Like, you may feel, listen, my child knows how to study and make opportunities available. If he wants to get an 80, not a 90, well, you know, wants to get a 70, I could try, I can encourage, but I don't want to get into a hassle right now about that. Or another parent might feel that's very important. Different parents have different values. But the school's going to tell you, you know, you need to make sure that he or she's doing homework. Why should I make sure that a child does the homework? The child's old enough to know to do the homework themselves. Or you may feel somewhat differently. The point is that it is, you know, those things are very complicated, and each parent, each child needs to work out what makes sense for that child. But you have another partner, you have a school, which has an expectation that you do things their way oftentimes. So it is difficult, but on the other hand, there's a very important value here. Children need to develop a sense of independence and to learn from the consequences of their actions. So when we get overly involved, the more anxious that we get, a lot of times there's an inverse relationship, the less anxious they get. You know, so some of you might have set up some kind of discipline program with your children, you know, it could be a chart or some kind of consequence. You might find yourself getting more nervous about what's going to happen when the consequence happens than when the child, than the child is. That's dangerous territory because the child picks up on it. It's like, you know, it's a game of chickens. The child sees that you're all worried about it. Hey, don't you know if you don't do your homework, you're not going to be able to have a friend sleeping over this Shabbos, you know? So the child gets the sense that you're more anxious about it than he is or she is, and then you know, you have a problem on your hands because it looks like you're, and indeed you are more worried. What's important is if you're going to do consequences, and again, that's a whole other discussion, how you do consequences, but if you're going to have some kind of consequence like that, like, you know, you have to do your homework or you know, maintain your grades if you want to have a sleepover or whatever you do, it has to be in a way where the rules are clear, but you're not emotionally invested. The less emotionally invested you are, the more the child has an opportunity to. You know, you want to be like a coach and an advisor to your child, but not like a nursemaid. You know, the kind of things you want to say is, well, I suppose you'd like to do well. I suppose you'd like to be able to have your friends over for Shabbos. So you might want to take a look at this. But, you know, as detached as you can be. Now, detached, I want to make it clear that detached does not mean, you're not detached from the child. You're detached from the performance. There's a very big difference. As a parent, you want to convey love and optimism, you know, and respect. You know, I know that you can do it. I'm sure you can do well on this. You have the ability to do this. I'm rooting for you. All those things, that's what you want to convey. But somehow or another, it's very different. You know, it's subtle, but it's different when you're invested in the outcome as opposed to being invested in the child's success for the child's sake. So you definitely want to convey that you care. And I'd like to see you succeed. I'd like to see you feel happy with this. How can I help you do this? But you don't want to be hovering that, oh, you know, you need to do this. You need to do well in school. You know, otherwise you're going to be a failure. Otherwise, you're going to bring shame on the family. All that is too heavy-handed. And what will happen is, I mean, some children do well with pressure for whatever reason. It appeals to them. They like responding to the pressure. But other children will bail out because you're not talking about them. You're talking about what you need, what you want, or what the family needs, what the family wants. Not all children are going to respond to, you know, the needs of the family as opposed to your own needs. So you need to watch that. Things like children are bored. They come to you and they're bored. It's a big problem. They're bored. So it's your job to make them happy. You know, Chol HaMoed is always a big thing, or weekends. So you can't abdicate your responsibility. We have a responsibility to help our children figure out what they need to do. But we also can't, if they're bored, it's not our problem. There's a big difference, you know. So you want to say something like, "Well, you know, what kind of activities do you want to do? You know, what do you need to feel entertained? You know, are there art supplies you want to get? You know, what is it that you need? I'm here to help you, but that's different than I'm here to entertain you." Now it's very important that the parent play with children on two levels. One is you play with them because it's the right thing to do, it's nice, and you want to be nice to your children, and they like to be played with. So you sit down with your children, you play a board game, or you have a family game. That's very appropriate. Another very important part about playing with children is that when you play with children, you teach them a lot of things. They learn rules, they learn sportsmanship, they learn self-control, you know, they learn respect. All those things by playing games are fabulous. But that doesn't mean you have to spend the entire afternoon playing with them. Yes, they deserve to play with you, and you should play with them. But, you know, sports, kids need to be taught how to throw a ball, they need to be encouraged to do those things, whatever. So I'm not saying that you abdicate and you're not 100% responsibility. The point is not to be overly responsible for your child's happiness, meaning you're fine, you play a game with them, but you can't entertain them the whole day. If they're unhappy or they're bored, you ask, well, what's going on? You need to invite friends over, you need to set something up, do you have your friends' phone numbers? You need activities, you need a new game to play, you want us to buy you a game. All those things within reason are what you do. You facilitate the solving of the problem of how they could be happy, but you don't have to take responsibility that they be happy. You want to be a coach and a facilitator but not a butler. And you have to watch that. It's hard to watch children fail, but it's very important that children sometimes fail, because that is right. That is the real way that people learn, you know, by trial and error. So if you never let your child make a decision, like, well, I have plenty of time to do the homework. I have plenty of time to do the book report. Well, don't you know, it's come down to the last minute. I have plenty of time. And then, you know, at the last minute, the child might do it or might not do it, or do it shabbily and get a bad grade, or do it shabbily and get a good grade, because you never know. That's the whole point. You can't get too involved. You could be a coach, you could offer your advice once or twice, but the child has to learn, and you can't create the circumstances. Life creates the circumstances. You might have a child that crams at the last minute and does okay. Is that the best MO? No, it's not the best MO. But if a child is doing okay in class, what are you going to do? Shouldn't do anything, because the more you get involved, you'd just be talking yourself blue in the face, and the child has it all figured out how to do it. You know, so you it's very important to, even though it's hard, to let children make their mistakes to a degree. Now, of course, you have to know how much at different age-appropriate levels. I mean, you wouldn't say, I want my child to learn how to cross the street, so I'll let him run into traffic. Can't do that. But at some point, that same child is going to be driving a car. So you do need to expose your child to experiences where, when they make these mistakes, they experience the brunt of those mistakes. You just have to be, that's the job of a parent, to know what type of exposure, you know, is safe and what type of exposure is not safe, because you can't expose a child to dangers that are too dangerous. But if you underexpose the child, he or she will not develop the ego strength, the character strength, the confidence, and the judgment to make decisions in life. So that's the balance. Do not be over-involved and overly invested in success. Don't go back on your word. That's commandment number 4. That's very important. You know, again, integrity is extremely valuable. Right? You don't have to promise a lot. You know, tzaddikim omrim ma'at v'osim harbe. You don't have to promise your children a lot. And if you tell your child you're going to do something, you can be clear that this is the plan. It might not work, but I believe it will work, and this is what I'm going to try to do. You don't want to convey pessimism or you know, overly obsessive. You know, I'm not guaranteeing it. You don't want to be like that. But it's also okay to be clear that this is, we're going to try to do this. It might not work out, but you think it's going to work out. You always want to convey, by the way, optimism in anything you do with children. It's very, very important. Optimism is a very important value, very important, you know, emotional state that you want to contage and pass over to your children. You do not want to contage pessimism to them. Even though the pressures in your life might be very difficult, or you might find in yourself that you tend toward pessimism, some people do, but it's not a good thing to give over to children. There's a lot of studies about this, about resilience. Children should, you should convey to them a general sense of optimism, not a sense that the world is unsafe and panic. So many times I'm going to say it in different ways, but I'm telling you this is very valuable. So, you know, you can tell your children, I'm not guaranteeing that we're going to do this, but you want to say, I really want to do it, and I think we could do this. So I hope we're going to be able to, next Sunday I'm going to take off a day, we're going to spend it together, it should work out, I hope it's going to work out, you know, barring any last minute problems. That's better than saying, I'm not guaranteeing, I want you to know, I'm not making any promises. That's too overboard for a child to process. You know, this is not a business arrangement. They want to see you're interested and you care and you expect the world to treat you well and that good things generally happen. By the way, that's completely irrelevant from how the world really is. Really, I'm not making it as a joke. The world itself is a very complicated place, and for some people, really difficult things happen. And we have a very strange way of understanding the world. You know, so for example, you'll buy a lottery ticket. You ask somebody who buys a lottery ticket, you ask them, well, you know, what do you think? I could win. Yeah, I think I could win. You know, it's always possible. They're already planning. Right? And if you ask somebody, God forbid, you know, what are your chances of getting cancer? You know, I hope not, but the sad fact is, I think there's like a 1 in 30 or 1 in 40 chance of getting cancer in your lifetime. Those are not good odds. But we don't think about that. Now, pessimistic people do think about that a lot. People that went through traumas think about catastrophe a lot. But it's not healthy. Because what happens is, when you think positive, doors open up to you, you see things in a different way, you convey a different sense to other people, you engage the world differently, and it actually becomes self-fulfilling. positiveness becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy and negativeness. So again, I digressed a little bit, but it's an important point. You always want to convey to your children basically an optimistic, positive expectation about things. Even if life hasn't always done that, it doesn't make a difference. You do the best that you can to convey that to them without it being Pollyanna, and they would be blind, you know, to the real risks of life. Anyway, don't go back on your word. So whatever it is, if you say you're going to do something, you really need to find every way to do it. If you can't do it, you know, come clean that you couldn't do it. But be clear that he made every effort. You just couldn't do it. Much better to be modest in what you offer. But whatever you offer, you really do have to try to do it. And children to see this with other people, that whatever you say, you know, that you're honest. That brings me back to, you know, punishments, because that's a big deal. You know, if you do, so to speak, issue a punishment, and now, for whatever reason, you don't think it's working. It's not working for the child. It's not accomplishing something. He or she is just overwhelmed or depressed by it. It's not really getting anywhere, or it doesn't fit your own plans. You know, sometimes we really don't want to punish the children because we need them to be in a better mood or more active or whatever it is. The reasons. So how do you go back on a punishment? It's not a great thing to go back on a punishment, but you know there is a precedent in the Torah itself that you know, a prophet, any prophecy that is good, that is a positive thing. So if it's made public, the Navi cannot go back on it. If it turns out that it didn't come true, then it's an indictment against the Navi. He's a false prophet. On the other hand, though, a prophecy for doom always can change. Like, you know, Yonah prophesied with Nineveh. Prophecy for doom can change because people could do tshuva. So there is such a thing as being consistent when you promise the goodies, but not being as consistent when you're issuing, unfortunately, a punishment or some kind of withholding. I think you got to talk about it. If for whatever reason you don't think the punishment's working, you say, well, you know, this doesn't look like it's working. What have you learned from this? You know, there's no reason not to talk to your child. You're not turning over the wheel, but you may need to modify the punishment, change it, recant on it, revise it. As long as you don't do it too often, it's really okay. Even in individuals, it's very interesting. And throughout Tanakh, there's some individuals that really did wrong things, and even when they asked for forgiveness, they weren't forgiven, and others that were partially forgiven, others that were completely forgiven. So, you know, Shaul was not forgiven for his mistake. Chizkiyahu was. He was told he was going to die right away, and he began to pray earnestly, and he was given 15 years on his life. Achav was partially forgiven. He was let off the hook, but his children were decreed to suffer. You know, it's very interesting. I suppose some of it has to do with the sincerity of the person who's doing tshuva, and part of it has to do with things that we don't fully understand. And same thing with our children as parents. You know, we have to make judgment calls. Sometimes we'll say, you know what, I get it. I see you're sorry. It's good enough. And sometimes we'll have to say, you know what, this has gone on too much. I don't want to make you miserable for no reason, but I think I got to stick with this, even though it's not so easy. But it'll be all right. Again, ending with something positive. Another few days, it'll be fine, and we'll go on. Something like that. But the point is that, in general, you want to keep your word, be a person of your word in every different way, because that creates security. That creates... You remember, the bottom line is your children, for better or for worse, are going to turn out a lot like you. Now, they won't turn out exactly like you, and sometimes one child will grab a hold of a certain character quality that you have. So sometimes in each of your children you might see different things, but they really do get a lot from you, a lot. And they don't only get it from what you do, they pick up how you feel, they pick up on what you believe. So there's a lot that they pick up. The better a job you do, the more material they have to work with, and it really counts. Okay, another big mistake, which many of us are fall victim to because, again, of our culture, and it's a little related to what we spoke about before, Which is, we should not become overly proud of our children's intellectual achievements. You know, because we come from a community where intellectual achievement is glorified and worshipped. I mean, this is just the way it is. We first of all, Kanahara, a lot of Jewish children are very bright. It really is a beautiful thing to see, although not all. And doesn't mean that they're any lesser. But we come from we have an intellectual tradition that's very powerful. It's helped us as a people. It continues to help us. But it's also very much our weak spot, because you can see that, especially today, you really do see sometimes people that are very developed intellectually, but their character, you know, is not developed. You know, the Mishnah and Abba says it's like a tree that has the branches are broader than the roots. So we saw that literally with the hurricane. You're going to get it blown over. So today there's a lot of emphasis on intellectual achievement, and the deeper aspects of character oftentimes don't, it's harder to reinforce those parts. It's very easy to reinforce intellectual achievement. And, you know, you have it in school, you have an honor roll. You know, where do you have a Midos honor roll? And even if you did have a Midos honor roll, even if you came up with such a thing, it's a very hard thing. I mean, how do you measure Midos? The person won the humility award. He graciously accepted the humility award. I mean, how do you even measure Midos? It's very, very difficult. So we have a double whammy. On the one hand, we definitely have a soft spot and a weak spot for bright kids. We love it. We love good kashas, kids that speak up at the table, you know, be the next Gadol Hador. We love that stuff. And aside from the fact that we do have somewhat of an obsession with it, on top of that, even if we wanted to equally promote, you know, Midos and character development, it's really hard, you know, so we have to focus on it. So you have to think about it for a minute. Intellectual achievement means different things to different children. You could have a very bright child who does very well, but he doesn't really have to try hard. And he gets all the praise and the attention compared to another child that has to try really hard to do well and does do well. So first you have to really look at, you really have to look at effort. Now the schools try, but the schools really, how much can they do? They got to work with grades to a large degree, although, again, that's another conversation. Are grades really that important? It's a very, very interesting and deep conversation, because, you know, I'll just allude to it and I'll say that, you know, a child gets 100 on a test, right? If you test that same child a month later on the material, most children do not know 60% of the material a month later. So what have we accomplished is an interesting question when we give a child a test and then they get a good grade on a test. It's, you know, it's an interesting question what we actually do in school, what actually happens in school. But fortunately, as parents, we don't have to worry about those problems. We just have to teach them the things that we do as parents. And we can pay a lot more attention to effort. So, you know, you really do need to look at what your child did. And when you see a child doing something that looks like it was good midos, it was a good decision. You know, a good decision is good midos too. A healthy decision. Or patience. Letting another, sharing with another child. It's important to really be effusive. And studies show, by the way, that it's okay, don't worry about it. I needed the break. It was good. It was entertaining.
I'm sorry.
Was that Lipa?
Yeah.
That was great. This guy's got a talent, let me tell you. Anyway, so, but getting back to the story, so, you know, the research shows that positive, effusive positive praise that's directed, you know, at the actual behavior is much more powerful than you know, even prizes and things like that. So, you know, you catch a child being good, you know, as the saying goes, and you identify, not you're a good person. Ugh, nobody's a good person. We all know. I mean, I'm sorry to say, at least I know this about myself. We're not all good people. If you tell a child you're a good person, the child feels uncomfortable to a degree because he or she knows she's not always good. There are times where they went to the cookie jar when you weren't looking and they took the cookies. So telling them they're a good person does not make them feel good. What you need to do is target very specifically what they did and say how you feel about what they did. So you let your you know, brother go first because you saw your brother was really upset and you let him go first. That was very considerate. That was a haftal reicha kamocha. I am very happy about that. That's clear, and you be effusive and strong in your language. That's right on target. It doesn't make the child a good person or a bad person. They just did a good thing, which you add up those good things. Of course, you're a good person, but you can't just say, you know, general things like you're a good person. Doesn't fly. It's not true, and child intuitively, you know, can understand that. So that's what you want to talk about. If a child does, you put in a lot of effort to get a good grade, of course you should talk about that. But you know, if a child seems to do effortlessly well, you could definitely use a good grade as a good grade. You can't fight that. You say that's very nice grade, beautiful. How do you feel about it? You know, the child feels very proud about it. It's one thing. The child might not feel proud about it either. Well, it was easy for me. Well, it's easier for you. That's good. You should be thankful to Hashem that you have such a smart head and it's easy for you. So you move on. You can recognize it, but you don't have to make a big deal about it. Make a much bigger deal about it when that child shows exceptional midos, because it's very easy for a smart child to be, quote, called a good child for not really doing anything at all other than being smart. So, that's very important. So let's you know, we want our children to do well intellectually, and we're going to talk more about promoting intellectual development in one of the other commandments. We want our children to do well, there's no question about it. But we just have to be careful of going gaga over intellectual achievement when really it's really not the big picture. And you know, smart people are not necessarily happier. They're not even necessarily more successful in the material world. They can be, obviously. Having intelligence is a great tool, but there are many successful people in business or otherwise that are not like the best academics. And there are people that are great academics and they're very successful, but their personal lives are in shambles because they don't have the right midos. So you know, it's great to have smart children, and it's great for children to be smart. But as parents, our job is far from done, because our children get hundreds on their tests, or 90s or whatever. Another important thing is do not pay too much attention to maladaptive behavior. This is very important. Children do wrong things. Child develop a bad habit, biting their nails, picking their nose, whatever it is. How much we invest in paying attention to this is important, because you know, if you get too reactive, this is really an emotional windfall of attention for the child. So it signals that something's going on. And it's a little dangerous to get overreactive. Sometimes there are things that really do bother us. For whatever reason, they really, you know, knock us for a loop. And we become overreactive. And we really have to watch that, because, yeah, as parents, we have to give discipline. We have to guide them. We have to tell them what's right and what's wrong. But if out of proportion we go bonkers about something, then we're just drawing a lot of attention to something that probably will pass. You just have to watch that, especially with any children at any age. You don't want to pay too much attention to a maladaptive behavior. You want to point out it's not a good thing to do. You really shouldn't do it. But if it's like a bad habit, they're stuck in it, take a break, leave it alone, let them figure it out for a while. Maybe 2 or 3 months later, you want to come back to them and say, you know, do you want to work on not biting your nails? Because it's really not a good thing. Do you want to work on it? If they say they don't want to work on it, forget about it. You're just going to get caught in this crazy cycle. You're not going to get anywhere. And with teenagers, you know, teenagers do experiment. They experiment with all kinds of things. And certainly some teenagers will stretch the boundaries of what are your family standards for Frumkeit. And for the most part, you should really try just to ignore it. It's very difficult, because They need to figure these things out for themselves. And if you get caught in this power struggle and you rob them of their autonomy, they just might keep testing themselves. You might want to discuss it. You might want to ask, you know. So, you know, I noticed that you're doing a lot of talking in shul lately. You know, in our family, we really don't talk in shul. We try to stay for the whole davening, and I see, you know, you're hanging out with your friends. What's going on? You could listen. You could hear. They'll probably give you an answer you don't want to hear, but you know, you got to hear it. And say, well, okay, you're okay with that? You're satisfied with that for now? I think you have to be a lot more collaborative, especially with teenagers, Is this something you want to work on? You know, do you believe it's the right thing to do? Or, you know, with the modes of dress also, it could become a very big issue. Maybe a child, your son or daughter, wants to dress in a certain way that is not so good by you. Or sometimes, you know, here's a problem again of being involved in a very close-knit community. Really, deep down, it might not bother you a whole lot, but you might feel embarrassed because it's not the standards, you know, of everybody else. And that's a problem. But, you know, you have to realize, if you really think it's okay, well, you don't think it's such a big deal, you have to stand by your child. Say, listen, you know, this is our community. It is a little embarrassing that you do this. I understand that you don't feel that comfortable with that or the other, or you want to try something different. Keep in mind, it is a little embarrassing for the family, but listen, if this is your choice, you know, I get it. That kind of thing. So, you know, you have to pay attention to what they're doing and get engaged, but that's different than getting alarmed or going wacko. And sometimes things, you know, they'll do really be a problem, but you have to differentiate between experimentation and rebellion. Now, if you've got a child that's really angry at you and wants to stick it to you, you have a problem. That's not regular, normal teenage experimentation. That's a child that's really angry and wants to stick it to you. And if you have that, you need to figure out, well, why does a child want to do that? There's something wrong in the relationship. There's no if, ands, or buts. It doesn't mean that you're a failure as a parent or anything, but all relationships take work, and every child needs something different. This child is really angry, and really, you get the sense this is not just about, you know, experimenting or finding his or her own place in life, but really wants to get into a fight with you or take you down. You're going to have to get some help on that. Either just learn more about it and see what's going on, see if you could repair it. If you can't repair it, find a way to repair it with some help, because, you know, that's a very big issue. And there's a difference. You know, you can sense it. You can sense whether this is hostility or this is their own need. A very big difference. And children do have to find their own place. But if they're hostile, they're hostile. You got to find out why they're hostile. Sometimes you got to draw the line. If you got to draw the line, be very, very careful. You know, some things have to be stopped. I mean, what if, your child's really, you know, running around with the wrong crowd or has friends, and you think you can have an influence. I mean, if you don't think you can have an influence, then why bother? But let's assume ultimately it'll be very ugly, but you're gonna have to draw the line on something you really think is unacceptable. It's unacceptable. So, first of all, double check. Really, make sure. Maybe get perspective from somebody else, because it's really not worth going to war if you don't have to go to war. But if indeed, after everything, it's unacceptable, you got to go to war. Go back to commandment number one. Listen really carefully. Point out this is a problem, but you want to hear their point of view. Listen really carefully. And after you listen really carefully, and you still feel there's no way around this and it can't be negotiated, say, listen, I understand and I get this is why you want to do this. And you, maybe at a different age, a different time in your life, you'd be entitled to make this decision. But right now, right here in this family, we can't do it. I gotta ask you to stop doing it. I have to insist. I don't like to take away from your personal choice. I understand you have a different view about this, but it's, you know, the house belongs to the family and you live here and we just can't do this. I will try to be flexible in a lot of different ways, or if you propose some kind of compromise, I'll try to work with you, but the answer is no. That's how you have to do it. If you got to do it, you got to do it. Sometimes, you know, today it's really hard. Chutzpah Yazgein, Ikvus and Mashiach, you know, in the footsteps of the times of the Mashiach, children are very chutzpahdik. You know, sometimes you can't win, but you could try, and if you really think that you have to, then you do it. But you do it in you know, in the most agreeable, collaborative fashion. What else? Well, another really important commandment is not to stop curiosity. That's very important. Children have a lot of questions. Smart children have a lot of questions. Even not smart children have a lot of questions. Everybody has questions, and everybody wants to learn. It's a natural, innate desire. If a child stops wanting to learn, it's only because somebody ruined it for them and made it really unpleasant, because it's a natural drive and instinct to to want to learn, and it's inherently pleasurable to learn. It feels good. It's like when you know you're doing a crossword puzzle and you figure out the answer, you get a boost. You feel good. For those of you that learn Gemara, you're learning Gemara and you're struggling and you finally figure out the pshat, it feels good. You actually, it's a physical pleasure. And children feel good when they learn something. So children are naturally curious. We have to be very careful not to squelch their curiosity. And a lot of times, school is not the best venue for them to have curiosity because they've got a curriculum and they've got 20-something other kids in the class and they got to learn. So that's funny, right? They have to learn. Therefore, they're not allowed to ask questions. But, you know, I mean, there's certain, you know, trade-off in mass education. But as parents, right, like I said, we have a different luxury. We have the time. And time, it doesn't have to be a lot of time. But if a child asks a question, really pay attention to the question. Treat the question seriously. It could be a smart question or a dumb question. It could be a heretical question. It doesn't make a difference. Listen to the question. Really take the question seriously. And try to provide some answer. At different ages, different answers, are required. But if you consistently respect your child's question asking, you'll get more questions, and your child will develop a more inquisitive, creative, and open mind. If a child asks a question and you're too busy to answer it, you don't treat that with respect, then you lose opportunities. So if you want to have creative children who think for themselves and have confidence in their own ability to assess and analyze, you really want to respect questions. Little children will ask, your two-year-old, three-year-old could ask, what's money or what's a credit card? You got to answer it. Find the simplest way, but meaningful way to answer it. Say it's a way of buying things. You don't have to give a doctoral dissertation to a three-year-old that asks you, what a credit card is. But it's a mistake not to answer the question because it's coming from real curiosity. What's a credit card? Well, it's a way that we buy things. Okay, fine. I use it in the store to buy things. But always go up to where they're up to, but answer questions. Because if you answer questions, they'll ask more. And if they ask more, it means they're learning and they're growing. And that's really, really what you want. That's very important. Another very important commandment is to share parts of your life with your child. Your child can only learn how to live from you. Now, you have to be very careful with the line. Your child is not your confidant, and you don't have to tell your child about all your stresses and all your miseries at work. That's not a good thing to do. You don't do that. But what you do is you talk about, what you do and why you do it. Whether you could be a doctor, you could be a lawyer, you could be a computer programmer, you could be a Rebbe, you could be a Rav, a teacher. You tell your child about what you do and why you do it. Something interesting that happened that week, what you enjoyed. You can tell it over at the Shabbos table. Again, you don't want to burden your child with a sense that even if your work is very stressful, that life is awful and there's so much work to do and how horrible your work is. You want to give them a sense of why you do what you do. Hopefully for a positive reason, because, again, they're trying to figure out what to do in life. They're going to figure it out by watching you. And if you... Even if you're not happy with your career choice, you want them to have a sense that people do things for a reason. They're connected to what they do. They feel good about what they do, so they can make better choices. Some people feel they feel all of a sudden very humble around their family members. Maybe you don't want to share that you accomplished something in learning or you accomplished a big thing at work, but it's a bad thing to do. Around your family members, you shouldn't be humble. Because you want your children to see that you're excited and happy and feel accomplished. And that's how that sense of confidence gets transferred to them. That's how that sense of optimism gets transferred to them. Another very big mistake is to not let children be children. There's certainly an urge to want children to behave and obey and be very studious. And it looks on the surface like, that's a great thing to do, to get great grades on tests and to be very serious and to daven very seriously and to learn very seriously. But you really have to make a mistake you have to be careful not to make the mistake of, you know, pushing a child and not letting a child be a child. There are a lot of interesting stories about this. Some of them I can tell you, you know, I have on really good faith, and other ones are just, you know, stories. Maybe they're true, maybe they're not. There's a famous story about Rav Aaronson Eibshitz. I have no idea whether it's true or not, but he was a real prodigy. You know, there are many Gedolim that were not prodigies. They just were very bright and diligent people who learned and learned. But there were some Gedolim that truly were, just prodigies. So Rav Aaronson Eibshitz was a prodigy. And by the time he was 9, he was giving a shiur, you know, to adults. And there was, there was some kind of donkey ride in town. He went on the donkey and started riding the donkey. And so some of the people objected and said, it's not fitting, you know, for our Rebbe to be riding a donkey. So he said, but I'm a 9-year-old who also likes donkeys. Supposedly that's the story, but it's a very good point. There's another story which is said over many times. I do believe I read once in an article that Rav Reuven said it himself, that he was learning with his father, and there was a hayride in camp, and his father told him to stop learning and go on the hayride. Of course, that brings to mind the whole bunch of other interesting observations, which is, why should we be so surprised that a father should be a father, even if he's a god of the Torah? I mean, we should do these things. We shouldn't be amazed. But nevertheless, for some reason, despite ourselves, we're amazed. But the fact is, you know, children have to be children. And you see also, there are many makaros. For example, we're not allowed to run around on Shabbos. You're not allowed to take what's called psia gasa, broad steps on Shabbos. That's a violation of onik Shabbos, which is a mitzvah drabanan, which is related really to a mitzvah deraisa of kiddush Shabbos. So It was instituted by the Rabbanim, but it's really fulfillment of a deeper concept, which is Daraisa. Kedusha Shabbos is Daraisa, but it's concretized into different things like not talking about Chol, or not rushing and running on Shabbos. But children are supposed to run. They're allowed to run because it's their onik. They're supposed to play games. So I don't know what age, you know, you draw the line, and maybe in different times there are different ages. I don't know about over Bar Mitzvah, but, you know, 10-year-old, 11-year-old kids that want to play basketball, throw on a Shabbos, let them play. This is what kids do. At what point you make the decision, that's up to every, you know, parent. And Rabba, it's very interesting. Rabba is a Gemara in Yuma. If you want to look it up, it's on Ayin Chesma Beis. He bought cheap, old like vessels for his kids to smash, because he knew the kids like to smash things. You have to understand, you know. What about Baal Tashkis? What about, you know, Kol Shover Kelim Mitoch Kaso, the Marin Shabbos? You're not allowed to break, you know, things out of anger, all that taboo and everything. And here he is buying vessels for his kids to smash. Because kids need to break things, because that's what kids do. So kids need to run around. So, you know, it's very nice. You might have a really unusual child who likes to sit in shul all day davening. You know, so every now and then you see these really great kids. I'm really jealous of those parents. I see a 7-year-old sitting there davening, the whole davening. I'm like, what is this? Like, what have I done with my kids? My kids can't even, like, you know, sit for 15 minutes. But the truth is, kids like to run around, you know? So, yeah, you want to teach them how to daven. You make some kind of deal. Come for a few minutes. At each age, you know, they have to take on more responsibility. It's appropriate. But please, let them run around. That's what kids are supposed to do. You know, if you have an exceptional child that doesn't do that, that could be a product of his exceptionality, or a product of his parents' exceptional obsessiveness. That all depends. Yes, you have a question. I think you have to really, today I think you have to figure out what really works for each child. I think it's a negotiation. There's nothing wrong with negotiating. Remember, davening in particular is very, very difficult. It's difficult for adults. Half the adults in shul don't even understand what they're reading. And they show it, because a lot of shuls, there's a lot of talking going on. I mean, the adults are barely functional when it comes to davening, quite frankly, let's be honest. So what the most important thing is meaning. You want to make sure that when your children are in shul, that they respect shul, that they see that you respect shul, that what they daven, they daven well. Far better for a 10-year-old to daven as much as he can and then leave, or maybe come back for landing and try to follow an aliyah or two. Far better that than have them come sit to the whole davening and twiddle their fingers and watch everybody else talking or whatever. So, you know, we have to use common sense. It's certainly davening, you know, you can make a whole talk out of davening. Davening today is a huge problem from beginning to end. It's a problem for the adults, it's a problem for the children, it's a problem. It doesn't mean that it's an insurmountable problem, but it means it requires a lot of deftness, a lot of broadness of spirit, a lot of creativity to really work well with children on that. Oh my gosh, I'm really running over time. I'll be finishing in 1 more minute. So the last one is, of course, last but not least, Achron, Achron, Chaviv. That's this week's Rashi. The last thing is the most important. We have to talk about boundaries, personal safety boundaries with our children. You know, to not do that is very dangerous. It's difficult. Sometimes it's embarrassing. We do it in the simplest way that they know how. There's some great books out there, but unfortunately, it's very hard to know really what works with each child, no matter what you do. But you do want to be clear. You do want to be clear the parts of their body that are covered by underwear no one ever should touch, except the doctor, and with your parents knowing about it. You want to be very clear about that. No adult ever, can tell you that it's okay without you talking to me. No one should ever scare you about that. But, there are children, no matter what, some of the predators are very, very, very clever. And they work hard on their victims. They groom their victims. There's a lot of work that goes into what predators do. They spend a lot of their time trying to figure out how to get children, and they know which children to get. But you have to do the best you can. This is a conversation that you have to have many times. Before camp, you have to have it. When you come back from camp, once during the year. Did anybody ever touch you? Anybody ever make you feel uncomfortable? It's a tough conversation, and at different ages, it has to happen in different ways. But you have to have it. It always was a problem, even in the time of the Gemara. It's very interesting. The Gemara made up, Chazal made up a rule. They said that they made up a certain tumah. I don't want to get into it because this is on a recording, but they created a whole category of tumah to keep people from letting their children play with other certain people because they were afraid that children would be molested. So why didn't they just tell the people, hey, don't let your children play with those people, they can get molested. They didn't do that because no one would listen. So they made up a whole category of tumah. Said, oh, tumah, I don't want my children to be tumah. So they made it up. The point is, molestation always was. I don't know whether it's now worse or better, but we got to deal with it. We absolutely got to deal with it. We got to talk about it. And just because you heard something, it doesn't mean that your child might tell you something. There's no need to panic, because I'm not trying to say this is a fun thing. But the fact of the matter is that a certain percentage, 40-50% of people that were sexually abused, really do not have any disabling or traumatic symptoms afterwards. Now, of course, those odds aren't great. I wouldn't want that to happen to anybody's child. But I'm just saying, because you hear that something happened, mild or major, don't panic. Because if you panic, your child panics. That's a very bad thing. Take it in, study it, get some advice. That's what you got to do. Anyway, those are the Ten Commandments. I got to start again very soon at 10:45. I can give out some cards. If you do have any questions you want to follow up, write in the subject line, OU Parenting, just so I'll recognize the email. And it was very nice talking with all you.